I felt kind of like ready to go to bat for Emily Dickinson. I guess I'm still kind of in that mood.
I'm Grace Groove Carlson, and you're listening to The Impulse Jewel. Today, we're talking about the Belle of Amherst, Emily Dickinson. Here to discuss her with me is Mellon Professor of English at Mount Holyoke College, Chris Benfey. Besides his work on Emily Dickinson, he's the author of books like A Summer of Hummingbirds, Red Brick, Black Mountain, White Clay, and The Great Wave, among others. Today, we talk about all kinds of things related to the poet, but I'm going to start out by talking about how his interest in her started and evolved.
I was kind of intrigued by Dickinson from a very early age. My mother had a bunch of little books. They looked like children's books. They were called Peter Pauper Press. And they had things like Aesop's Fables and Fairy Tales and Haiku. And one of them was Emily Dickinson's Love Poems. And even when I was really young, I was really curious about these poems. Some of them seemed really easy to understand, and some of them were really hard and complicated, and I felt like the book kind of had secrets that I would eventually understand, the way parents' books often have that quality. But I didn't really get hit hard by Dickinson until I was in graduate school, and I was reading a lot of European poets, and I was interested in what makes poems hard to understand, and why we like poetry, even if it's kind of impenetrable sometimes, or at least why I do, why some people do. And I started reading Dickinson's poetry in a seminar, and I thought, these poems are unbelievable. I mean, these are as good as anything out there. You know, I felt kind of like ready to go to bat for Emily Dickinson. I guess I'm still kind of in that mood. I'm ready to go to bat for this poet. She just seems to me like the real McCoy. So, what about you? What did you what did you learn after your summer of working at, did your feelings change about Dickinson as you were hanging out at the homestead and where she was born and died and the Evergreens where her beloved brother and her sister-in-law?
The tour guides and the people who ran the house would kind of like gossip about the family, like different stories that they knew that like maybe other people didn't. So my first day there, they were all like talking about who they thought Emily was in love with, like all the different suitors that they thought she might have had, and pulling out books with like pictures of them to see which ones they thought were cute.
Though her relationship with Otis P. Lord shortly before her death is the only confirmed romance in Dickinson's life, scholars and fans are constantly speculating on who her passionate love poems may have been about, as well as drafts of mysterious love letters addressed to someone she called Master. Many posit a love relationship between Dickinson and her sister-in-law, Susan. Some people mention family friends like George Gould, Benjamin Franklin Newton, or William Smith Clark. Some people connect her with the editor of a local newspaper, Samuel Bowles. And some people think she had a relationship with her friend, Kate Anton, who left America and became part of an open lesbian relationship.
And I remember one of the house managers was saying that Austin and, what was the name of, not his wife, but
Mabel Amistad.
Yeah, Mabel Amistad would like go up to the cupola to have their affair, which I don't think there's actually any evidence of that. I think right. It was just an idea she came up with. But it was really fun to gossip about a family that has been there so long ago.
Right.
We just have to wonder.
But that's that weird quality of Dickinson, that she does feel kind of contemporary. And it's interesting to learn that the people surrounding her were not these well-behaved Puritan New Englanders, but you know that it was a very passionate place with a lot of deep romantic passion. How could it not be? I think a lot of people who approach the Dickinson family, the Dickinson families, go in with the idea that they're going to run into these well-behaved, buttoned-up, kind of perfect little Christians, and they discover that this is a kind of familiar landscape of passion and violence and anger and also just daily, you know, keeping the house clean and keeping the horses fed and keeping food on the table. One of my favorite lines from Dickinson in a letter, she says, "House is being cleaned. I prefer pestilence." You know, it's just a reminder of how much time women, and they were always women, spent keeping the house clean in the 19th century. There were no vacuum cleaners. There were, you know, it was just really backbreaking work. And Dickinson did a lot of the baking in the house, a lot of the cooking. She said her father only liked her cooking, so that's what she had to do.
Knowing all of this makes it even more remarkable that in her lifetime, Dickinson composed almost 1,800 poems. And these were just the ones she deemed worthy of saving and compiling.
When I first got there, they just had me like taking a tour a day with all the different tour guides, and I learned everything there is to know because they all explain it in kind of like a different way, and some of them would read poems in certain rooms. And there was this one that I really liked. Let me try to find it. "The bird her punctual music brings and lays it in its place. Its place is in the human heart and in the heavenly grace. What respite from her thrilling toil did beauty ever take? But work might be electric rest to those that magic make."
Great. I love the idea of electric rest. That
yeah,
is so...
That's
part of it. I know. That is so Dickinson.
Are there any poems, like, right now that are capturing your attention by her?
Yeah, actually, funny you should mention that. This morning, I was thinking about spring and everyone talking about spring is coming. March is just around the corner. And I started thinking, for no good reason, that I kind of dread spring. and then I immediately thought of this Dickinson poem. It happens a lot with me, that she's found a way to express what I'm thinking about.
"I dreaded that first robin so, but he is mastered now. And I'm accustomed to him grown. He hurts a little, though. I thought if I could only live till that first shout got by, not all pianos in the woods had power to mangle me. I dared not meet the daffodils, for fear their yellow gown would pierce me with a fashion so foreign to my own. I wished the grass would hurry, so when 'twas time to see, he'd be too tall, the tallest one could stretch to look at me. I could not bear the bees should come. I wished they'd stay away. In those dim countries where they go, what word had they for me? They're here, though. Not a creature failed. No blossom stayed away in gentle deference to me, the queen of Calvary. Each one salutes me as he goes, and I, my childish plumes, lift in bereaved acknowledgement of their unthinking drums."
I dreaded that first robin so. You know, it's just kind of so Emily Dickinson, like everyone else is saying, oh, cold New England winter, I can't wait for the spring and the robins come. And she's saying, God, I dread that. You know, she says she dreads the coming of the bees. She dreads the daffodils, all of those things that... everyone else is longing for. And she just has this way of saying things that nobody should say and capturing someone. I mean, she has another poem that begins, I like a look of agony because I know it's true. You think, really? Like you like seeing people in pain because you believe they're not faking it? But I guess it's sometimes Dickinson's willingness to just speak what many of us have thought and just putting it out there.
Do you think that that's one of the reasons that she's aged well?
Yeah, she hasn't just aged well, she's aged great. You know, her following, not just in New England, not just in the United States, but around the world, just keeps growing. She's been a world poet for a long time, but it seems like in the past 20, 30 years, that has really just changed exponentially. Yeah, I think her voice seems fresher than ever. It's hard to read Longfellow now or Emerson or, you know, some of these poets, Oliver Wendell Holmes, that were really, really popular when Dickinson was alive. And they just sound like they have cobwebs on every word. And Dickinson just seems more and more immediate, you know?
I'm nobody. Who are you? Are you nobody too? Then there's a pair of us. Don't tell. They'll advertise, you know. How dreary to be somebody. How public, like a frog. To tell one's name, the livelong June, to an admiring bog.
I'm nobody. Who are you? Are you nobody too? You think, how did she write that in the 1860s? You know, how does she get that contemporary voice?
I remember while I was doing my exhibit, I had a poem in it that was like lesser known, and people kept saying like, oh, I haven't seen that one. I felt like I was like very impressive for pulling out one. Are there ever ones that you noticed that you haven't read before, or have you like gone through them all?
Both. I mean, I've gone through them all many times, but I'm still astonished by poems that I've never seen before. I just think, she wrote that. And there are a lot of her poems that have really never been written about. You know, you would think that this writer who was known to everybody with some of her poems, that somebody must have commented on all of them at some point. But there are almost 2,000 poems. And one critic said it's harder to keep all of her poetry in your mind than all of Shakespeare. Because they're all relatively short poems. Whenever I pick up Dickinson's poetry, whenever I teach it, I see poems that, to my shame, are totally, totally new to me.
Do you think that there's like a unifying quality with all her work, or do you think it's more varied? And you can't really see anything tying it all together.
I don't think there's a big system to it. It's hard to say at any given point, this is what Emily Dickinson believes. You know, this is what she believes about death, or this is what she believes about nature, or this is what she believes about God. This is what she believes about men and women. This is what she believes about love. I think she used her poetry to try to figure out what she thought about those things. I think, you know, there are probably two kinds of writers who sit down and say, I know what I want to say, now I'm going to say it, and writers who sit down and say, I have no idea what I'm going to say. Let me put some words together and see what I think. And I think another reason why Dickinson appeals to us is that there's something exploratory about her, that you feel that she's trying things out, you know. Because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me. You think, what? Like, where is she going with this? She's obviously intrigued by the idea that maybe death isn't so bad. Maybe when death comes, we'll be kind of okay with it, even if we're not thinking, okay, now's the right time. But there is that kind of questing quality about her. She once said that she dreaded men and women because they talk of hallowed things aloud and embarrass my dog. And I love that. I mean, there's partly a feeling that that people just say kind of what they feel they ought to say about big subjects, and Dickinson is really wary about that. She's really kind of, let's think twice before we say things that will embarrass our dogs.
Yeah, I think that's what gives her poetry that exactness that is really special. And I was talking about that. I was kind of exploring that when I did my exhibit on her, how seriously she took words and how you use them and the power that they can have.
Absolutely. Yeah, I remember when you and I talked about that exhibit you were working on. Yeah, she says something like, I never use a word I cannot lift. You know, she absolutely careful with words, not trying to say something bigger than she feels comfortable with. And really zeroing in on individual words. Her literary advisor, Thomas Wentworth Higginson, asked her a bunch of questions that I'm sure he thought were softball questions, you know. Like, he says, how old are you? And she says, I've only been a poet for 6 months or something like that. And, you know, could you send me a photograph? And she says, no. But could you believe me without? You know, I'm small like the rim, et cetera, et cetera. And I can imagine Higginson saying, just send me the photograph. You know, don't give me those poetic descriptions. But she also says that she had this tragedy when she was young. And she says that for a while, my lexicon, my dictionary, was my only companion. And I think that tells us a lot about her, that she was pretty obsessed with individual words. I know you and I have talked about how you know, she lived across the street from where Noah Webster lived, mm-hmm. who was the greatest of American dictionary writers. He wrote the first great American dictionary, and she has an interest in individual words just like a dictionary maker would, but she's got really different definitions. You know, some of her most famous poems are these alternative definition poems, like hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul, or she tried to define faith. Faith is the peerless bridge. You know, all of these presentiment is that long shadow on the lawn, indicative that suns go down. The notice to the startled grass that darkness is about to pass. You say, oh, that's what presentiment means, you know? That's not what I would have heard from the dictionary. But yeah, really, I mean, I think like a painter who has a special feeling for colors like Van Gogh and yellow, like all of those yellows that Van Gogh uses, you feel like nobody sees yellow the way he does. Or the way a composer would have a feeling for a particular key or a particular chord. I think Dickinson is like that with particular words, and you think, God, you know, or mathematicians with numbers. I imagine that certain prime numbers just really galvanize mathematicians. my friend Juliana Davidoff in the math department, she said that number theorists start with, you know, pick a prime bigger than 2 or something like that. And I can imagine, you know, mathematicians having a line about numbers like poets having about individual words. They're just exciting to them. And I think we don't feel that with a lot of poets. You feel they're using words to say things. Mm-hmm. Whereas Dickinson, you feel like she's just obsessed with how that word is shaped, what it looks like, what it feels like. You know, she has this unknown poem about pain again. Like, I like a look of agony, and it begins, must be a woe, W-O. And I think the word woe, which was an alternative spelling for W-O-E, just fascinated her. That big W and the O and and that's how she was with a lot of words. They were sort of magical, like witches' spells or something, you know, like.
That is all the questions that I have.
Nice.
Is there anything else if you wanted to read a poem to end or anything else you wanted to talk about?
Oh, well, it's great. It's great talking to you. I think I'll read one of my favorite little animal poems. This is a poem that is in the form of a letter. Emily Dickinson's favorite literary genre, I think, was the letter, the personal letter. And it's a fly writing to a bee. So this goes back to the coming of spring. But I just love how natural this poem is. At this point, my students say, stop talking and read the poem. So here's the poem. Bee, I'm expecting you. Was saying yesterday to somebody you know that you were due. The frogs got home last week, are settled in at work. Birds mostly back, the clover warm and thick. You'll get my letter by the 17th. Reply, or better, be with me. Yours, fly.
That's really funny. Well, thank you so much.
Oh, it's been a great pleasure, Grace. Thank you for inviting me.
If you enjoyed this conversation, you can read one of Professor Benfey's books on Emily Dickinson, or some of his work on other writers and subjects, much of which can be found in the New York Review of Books. The Impulse Jewel is written and edited by me, Grace Grieve Carlson, and produced by WMHC, radio out of Mount Holyoke College. Many thanks to Tim Dietrich and the rest of the team there. Our intro and outro is courtesy of the band Moth Puppy. The song is Cranberry Juice. Another huge thank you to Professor Chris Benfey. If you're wondering, an Impulse Jewel is a small, delicate piece of a manual watch. Thank you for tuning in.
Oh, I love all the CDs around the tents. Or, you know, yesterday's technology.